Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the After Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Oh, yes, y'all.
And chiming in is the ever-present Bryce.
Hi. He's with you at all times.
Yeah, Bryce is wearing his Wiener Unicorn Pegasus shirt there.
It says believe.
Yeah. Wiener Dog Unicorn Pegasus.
Let's jump right in there. For those of you who don't know, on the After Things show is we talk a lot about being a creative, pursuing your creative ambitions, building small businesses, et cetera. And, you know, we weigh in with our experiences. I'll use the word experience instead of expertise, because that would imply that we know what the hell
we're
talking
about. We knew
what
we're doing, yeah.
Not at all. And this comes in from the first topic here. If you have one, by the way, you can send it to neshcom@gmail.com. neshcom@gmail.com and put subject line After Things. And please put After Things in the subject so poor Bryce knows what he gets way more email than any human should.
Yes, please.
So James writes us, hey, boys, sorry, men.
No, I think he meant, Harrison, hey, boys, here. Sorry, men.
Yeah,
unless he means like he pities us. Yeah. Hey boys, sorry men.
It took me a while to write this email, but my question is this: that should be a semicolon there. What do you guys do to combat procrastination? Some days I just don't want to go do the boring parts of show business, invoices, bookings, phone calls, etc. As I'd rather just go perform. Any tips on how to fight this? Do these tips translate to other things like writing, doing a podcast, starting a YouTube channel? Yeah, I've never had a problem with procrastination ever.
Oh, jeez. Ever. Well, and it's especially tough. So let's talk about I think you and I are fairly qualified to speak on the unique fusion that being a self-employed entertainer represents. In that, when you begin, you do not have the fantasy of everyone. Is that they all want to believe that, like, well, I just make the art and then somebody else does all the business stuff and they'll work real hard and get me booked and I don't have to worry about that. It's a fantasy. It'll never happen.
Yeah.
Everybody would do well to let go of that now and forever, starting right this minute.
Yeah. Listen, procrastination is probably the two enemies you have to deal with. Is one is procrastination, the other one is a lack of introspection and not having an ability to get better. And yeah, and it's funny, like, yeah, that if somebody else does this, I all the time on Twitter, I just got this, like, somebody's like, hey, I got a lot of great ideas for books. Well, that's wonderful. You know,
yeah,
that's great. You but, know,
oh no, I just thought I would be the idea guy. I'd give you the concept and then you could run with it and maybe we could both put our names on the book.
Let me iterate to this audience. When I was a kid, I used to tell my dad, what's this idea? My dad, like, ideas aren't worth anything. And I'd be like, nah, it's a great idea. And then as I get older, I get, and the more ideas I have, the more I realize, oh yeah, no, ideas really aren't worth. Some ideas are better than others, but it doesn't mean that they have value outside of that class of ideas.
Well, let's be fair and say not that ideas are worthless, but that ideas truly are a dime a dozen. Like they are so bountiful, you can find them sidewalks littered with them.
You can rate one idea over another. They have a value inherent to other ideas, but the value of them outside of, you know, having any sort of effort put into them is next to zero.
Correct.
So, but yes, some inflated African currency is worth more than some other inflated African currencies. And you know, there've been cases too of, you know, your Confederate dollars too. Let's not pick.
Sure.
What it comes down to is procrastination, and I deal with this all the time. I watched 6 episodes of Mr. Robot. Granted, I was sick, you know, and I should have been working on my 3rd Jessica Blackwood book, and I may have, you know, to answer to my editor for this. But, man, laying in bed and not moving just seemed much more appealing than moving and doing something. And I will tell you, the simplest answer to procrastination is this, and you're going to go, oh, it's so simplistic. And I said, that's the reason that it works. And this came from reading, I think, one of the greatest motivational speakers and people that you, if you read deeply into them and you're a student of them, not everybody's a fan, probably fewer today than there were before, but still somebody who is a very, very fascinating.
Bill
Arnold
Cosby.
Schwarzenegger.
Oh, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, are fewer people a fan once he got political and ran California for a bit?
That, I think, the infidelities and some other stuff.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
He's a complicated guy. But Arnold was this, you know, this skinny Austrian kid that decided that he wanted to be famous and he didn't know what that outlet was going to be. You know, he wanted to be a skier, but he wasn't going to be the best skier. Wanted to be a soccer player, wasn't going to be the best soccer player. You know, he wanted to be a strong man and was very strong with, admittedly, considerable amount of chemical enhancement. You know, he does not shy from that at all now. But then he realized that he only had a limit there. But then he found that bodybuilding was going to be his thing. That he searched for a thing that fit him best rather than latch on to the one thing that he wanted. He found something that wanted him as much as he wanted it. But his mantra was when he went into the gym, and he is a very intelligent guy. Very, you listen to him talk, you follow the course of what he's done. This is a guy that, you know, to do what he's done, you cannot just be a dumb guy. You got to have a lot of intelligence behind what you're doing. His mantra was, and he got made fun of for this, but was, don't think, just do it. Don't think, just do it. And what he's basically saying is when it comes into like going to the gym, don't think about going to the gym. Go to the gym. If you want to go do 10, you know, push-ups, just go do 10 push-ups. The more you think about it, the more time you spend the more time you think trying to come up with reasons to do this or to not do this, you will come up with reasons not to do it. And if you want to get away, if I need to get something done, if I do not want to, if I have to write or whatever, you know what I do? I do a loop, a mental loop. I don't go through a lot of reasons to motivate. I just sit down at my computer, open up my screen, and I start it. I don't think about anything else. I don't put any other distractions in there. I just go do it. And that's the whole idea of just do it. Is like, don't, if you put yourself, if you give yourself, if you're intelligent, people will come up with excuses, will come up with reasons not to do it. The longer you think about it, the longer you look for an excuse to get past it. How do you, you know, if you want to go for a walk, put on your damn walking shoes. If you want to go to the gym, put on your gym clothes. Don't think about it. Don't try to talk yourself into it. Get rid of that.
Well, and having said that, there's there are practical things you can do outside of, yeah, and yes, in a the perfect solution is to, well, just shut up and do it. However, as the cliche goes, the perfect is the enemy of the good. I think there are good structures that you can set up for yourself. And as my dad often told me, nothing inspires creativity like a deadline. And I would go a step farther and realize nothing inspires compromise like a deadline, which sounds like mm-hmm. a bad thing, but compromise can be a very, very good thing if it's the difference between something happening and not happening. Committing yourself to, by Friday, having called 20 places to see if anyone wants a free sample show to book your stage show or whatever, when that deadline comes, you will either have done it or not. And if you're somebody who's uncomfortable with saying you're going to do a thing and then not actually doing it, you will compromise and you'll look at your list of people and say like, well, I did have ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox on my list, but I don't really know who to call at those places. And it is Thursday night and tomorrow's going to be Friday and I'll either done it or not. So let me open up the Yellow Pages, as if we live in an age where the Yellow Pages were relevant. You know, let me open up Yelp and type in comedy clubs and the Yuck Yuck Chuckle Hut is right here in town or it's an hour away. It's not my perfect solution, but if it's a matter of either I called them or I didn't call them, I will call these less perfect venues because I know they're much smaller and I'm much more likely to get to a decision maker immediately. And at least I'll have come down on the side of having followed through on that stuff. So failing the ability to just, you know, muscle up the gumption to go out and do a thing, at least set up a structure that forces you to a binary position where either you did it or didn't do it, and it allows for, even if you did it with compromise, it wasn't the perfect version, but at least it was done. At the end of the day, you did it instead of sitting around talking about it. That's the one thing you don't want to be, is the guy who's constantly talking about the solutions he's going to implement to fix a thing in the future eventually.
I certainly agree to the latter. I would say that I think that there is, and I'm going to be very artificially binary here, I think there are zeros and ones. There are people I know who get things done, and there are people I know who don't. And the people who do struggle still with getting things done, but when they set themselves to do it, they end up getting it done. And then there are people who are very good at inventing excuses and compromising those compromises and compromising those compromises, and they put themselves into shame spirals and they don't get anything done.
Well,
and
just to clarify, when I say compromise, for example, I had an idea for a routine in which I would make a ghost appear on the cell phone of every person in the audience, and I committed to myself to, like, come hell or high water, in 3 days, I'm going to perform this at the local Magic Club meeting. I had a perfect vision of what this would look like, and I had a demonstration of the technology that would make it possible. I up against a deadline, I had to compromise. I didn't have a perfect script. I didn't go through 5 revisions like I thought I would. I didn't tell an amazing detailed story that inspired everyone. But at the end of the day, as raw as that thing was and as bare bones as that routine was, I did it and I made that thing appear in front of them. And so that's what I mean by compromise.
Yeah, but you didn't start off with the compromise. You got to the point where you took it as far as you could. And that's the key, is to say that if I guess that's the danger, is that if you say, okay, I'm a big believer, like, have a loose enough, you know, have a mark that if 3 days prior you would say, yes, if I hit within the circle, it's a success. I know what the center of that circle is going to look like, and I'm going to shoot for as close as I can. But if I hit within that circle, I will be happy.
Correct.
And that's like when I talk about writing deadlines for people. I'm like, yeah, 2,000 words a day is great, but you know what you should be happy with? If you just sit down every day and at least write one word. If you can do that, and we talked about Power of Habit, that book's fantastic. You know, you do that for 40 days. I was getting sloppy with my writing habits, so I made a commitment every day for 40 days without a day off. I sat down and I wrote 2,000 words a day.
This ties back to your theme of binary zeros and ones. When I say compromise, like, pretty much going from zero to one, zero to anything is the hardest thing, because pretty much everything after you've gone to something is a matter of fidelity, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. You could be very, very far off in terms of fidelity, but as long as you made that leap from zero to something, then that's the standard that you should at least hold yourself to.
When I knew 10 years ago that I wanted to get on TV and I wanted to have a TV show, I made a commitment that when I woke up in the morning, the first goal that I had to do was to move that closer, was to move myself closer to that finish line.
Do literally anything, whether it was making a list of people that you intended to call that day on a piece of paper or something.
Yeah, it was that everything else was secondary to that priority. If there was something that I knew that I could be doing, making the calls, making the video or doing whatever, that came first. Everything else was secondary, to the point that if I didn't get enough done in a week, I would not go out on a Friday night. You know, I would not go out. And to the point I was uncomfortable hanging out or doing things if I didn't do enough. That was when I knew I was on a path to probably achieve success or spectacular flame out, was when I reached that point where I was uncomfortable if I wasn't pursuing. And that's where I got with writing. I got to the point where, like, and I was super, like, I need to be able to figure out how to slip into that mode as easily as I can. When I got to that point where I felt uneasy, I could not go to sleep if I didn't write. And we talk about, like, yeah, 40 days is roughly the period of time of doing something every single day that it takes to build a habit.
So, and by the way, that's as far as we know, fairly scientifically determined, in that they what was the experiment? They asked people to commit to a thing and just say, every day, just self-report, like, did you do the thing or not? And then that's the balance they figured out, is beyond 40 days, you had diminishing returns. Pretty much, if you were going to do a thing, you did it for 40 days and then it stuck forever, right?
Yeah. you know, the way that I've been spending a lot of time with code lately, so I tend to think about things in that sort of context. If you have a really long program, there's the greater chances you're going to have a bug or something's going to derail what you're trying to do. And the more time you spend trying to think about what you're going to do or build an elaborate plan, the more opportunities there are going to be to derail yourself. And I've talked about this in my books, you know, The Cure for Writer's Block and How to Write a Novella in 24 Hours. The biggest problem when you're a creative person is you can always create an out. You can always create a better solution for you to get out of it. That's very much where you can say, this is my plan. I'm going to go make this movie. I'm going to do this. 2 weeks in, production's rough. Your extras aren't showing up. People aren't participating the way that you hoped. You're like, you know what? I got a better movie. I got a better idea.
Right.
You know what? I learned a lot. I got a better idea. I'm going to put this one down. I can come back to it, but I'm going to go do this thing because I think this is really where – what your goal is to finish a damn thing. It's like a book. People are like, yeah, I had this idea in another book. Like, you know what? If you never finish a book, you've never finished a book. The quality of the book is irrelevant to finishing your first damn book.
Dude, that's a really good point, man. Finish a damn anything. That's your goal. And one thing, one word you use, just like I want to defend compromise, I want to encourage people not to fall into the seductive trap of thinking about excuses. We all know that excuses are bad. We all know that, oh yeah, no, let's not make excuses or whatever. But nobody thinks of excuses, your own excuses, as excuses. What you should be, the way you self-delude yourself, the way you trick yourself into following into a trap is by not calling them excuses, but instead explaining with really good reasons what's going on. Hey, you wanted to be on TV, Andrew. Have you called anyone today? No, Brian, I haven't. Why not? Well, I called 20 people the other day, and I'm waiting on a call back. And to which I say, that doesn't sound like an excuse. Those sound like really good reasons you haven't done anything today. And that is what's so seductive about it. Do not fall for reasons. Do not fall for that trap.
I'm going to tell you, like, I would say for the last 6 or 7 years of my life, I've never been bothered with the question of like, what have you been up to? What's been going on? Because I feel like I've always been able to miserably move that forward. And sometimes it's not from external validation. You know, if it's neat to say, hey, I just got nominated for this award, or hey, this thing's selling really well, but I can just as equally say, oh, I just finished writing this book, or I finished doing this thing. And so I've always felt very good on my personal achievement level, because even more so with the stuff that I, you know, the self-determined stuff. And I think that if you move yourself by those standards, you have a thing to build upon.
Yeah.
And so I answered the question from the chat room. Tensor guy, what language am I learning? Ruby. Ruby's been the one I've been doing. And I've been using everything from Code Academy, Code School to Treehouse, and trying to get that through my head. And now I'm moving on to Rails.
You know, that's another one of those traps that we fall into, is thinking that you only get one at bat and that you don't want to finish a thing and have it be less than the awesomeness you imagine. Instead, you should not be thinking about your first movie or this one movie you're thinking of. You should be thinking, how good do I want to be at age 67? And how what will my story be? Will my story be that at age 67, I took 40 plus years working on restarting, half finishing a bunch of movies, and then made one movie that was really good?
Yep.
Or should the story be, when you're 67, that I've done 675 films and they all were terrible except for the last four or five, but all of them won Academy Awards? You know, what I mean by that is my perspective has shifted. I look back over the grand total of Scam School, and there's a lot of Scam School episodes where I'm deeply disappointed in my own performance or the environment that we performed in or the material I felt like I didn't do justice to. But the volume gets turned down on all of that now that we're past 500 episodes of this thing. And if I'm 67 and we're up to 23,000 episodes of Scam School or whatever, and then like the last seven are the best thing I ever did, I'm okay with that. But the difference is you've got to finish individual things to get there.
Yeah, if you have a process to get better and to improve, then you're in a good situation. The thing that kind of makes me roll my eyes is one is when, you know, people say I don't watch TV, and for a reason that's irrelevant, but like, you know, I don't watch TV. I just roll my eyes. I used to be the guy that says that, and that's non sequitur here. The other one is, you know, I'm a bit of a perfectionist. And when somebody tells me, like, oh, you know, like, I want you, it's like, I'm a bit of a perfectionist. It's like, okay, so you're the only one in the world with taste. You're the only one in the world that cares about making things good. That sounds to me like you're a procrastinator. It sounds to me like you're a zero and out of one. It sounds to me like you're a person looking for an excuse, and you're using the idea of like, well, yeah, no, I want it to be really good.
So and restating it, it's what does it mean to be a perfectionist in that context? What they're really saying is, I'm somebody who would rather release nothing than release something that I'm worried I would take any kind of criticism for.
Yeah,
that's and guess what? The perfectionism that you seek does not exist. There is literally not any piece of art, certainly not art worth a damn, that you could release that somebody will not hate in this world. There is no perfect.
Yeah, and that's not an excuse to do crap at all. And sometimes means finishing. It means just finishing it and then putting it on a shelf and moving on to the next thing. That's. Sometimes that's maybe the right approach.
Yeah. Anyway, so I guess to James's question, figure out a way to hold yourself accountable, and that's the important thing.
Yeah, James, the thing to commit yourself to is don't think about how much time you do, but at least pick, you know, a time to say tomorrow you get up, whatever, you're going to spend the first hour of the day doing X, working on that thing. You have to understand that as part of what you need to do. And, you know, it's we'll all attest to when you set out that list of 10 things you need to do the next day, and when you get them done, it feels amazing. So commit yourself to the idea of sitting down at some point. I'm going to stand here. Sometimes it might even mean have a different workspace, that when you sit down at this workspace, this is what you're going to do.
Can I just say there that I love this idea of perfectionism in the 0-1 binary structure. When somebody says they're a perfectionist, they're saying I'd rather not release it than take criticism from it or have it be, let's say, you know, 60% good rather than 100% good. Yes, I understand that impulse, and I understand releasing stuff that you're not going to like afterwards or want to disown. But meanwhile, another way to put it is I'm so uncomfortable with taking criticism from the people who won't like what this is aiming, what this is on track to be, that I would rather not release it and deny access to it to the 30% of my fans who will really, really dig it. And specifically, I remember a time that I was really excited because I had tracked down a bootleg of Penn and Teller's show. Was it Phobophilia? And there were parts of it that I really, really liked and I was really, really excited about. And I remember as a fan saying, oh man, I just saw Phobophilia. And before I got to say another word, Teller said, could have been a good show. Really disappointed with it. And all of a sudden I felt like a chump for having liked it. I had, you know, and thank goodness they released it. Thank goodness that they were ones instead of zeros, right? And it's great that he had things that he was disappointed about. But somewhere out there is a Brian Brushwood. And specifically what made me think about this is Jackie Hearn in the chat room just pledged to release her hoarded claymation videos that she hadn't released because they suck. Fine. You may think they suck, and they may be miles short of where you wanted them to be. But out there is a Brian Brushwood who really wants to see them. And you decide which is more important, to avoid criticism by not doing anything, or to make that 30%, that lesser, that small amount of people happy by getting more of that stuff.
Or I mean, an alternative might be that if there sometimes like there are books that I should not release because, you know, people might read these things and then come to an unfair opinion of where I am now. But they might be things that I might let a small group of friends read, you know, and this might be a thing that you might, you know, show it to a group of friends, see what they say. It's like, oh, this is great. Like, oh, that's fun, whatever. The more important part is you got it done. You did it.
Yes.
You did it. And if you have enough information from there to move on to the next project, then that's great. If you got enough of that experiment, you have the results. You're like, aha. Now I know how to iterate it, make it better, then that's great.
And that's a good point. I guess we're talking less about the releasing aspect but more about the completion of the thing. That's what really matters.
Yeah, and I think completion and having, you know, I try to write down like – I've said this before. When I write a book, I'll then read a book on writing, you know, and then I get in a point where I write a book and then I will make notes about this book, what I thought I hit, what I didn't hit, and whatever. And a lot of times I can predict what the feedback might be from a publisher because I'm like, yeah, no, I know they're going to say this or whatever. And it's because I'm so familiar now with finishing things, I'm not too attached. You know, if they don't like something, that's great. I can write more. And I think if we're getting that position, like, you know, YouTube videos, guess what? You didn't like it this week? Watch next week.
Right.
You know, keep iterating. So do we have time for me to run a thought by you?
Yeah.
A business plan?
Yeah, sure, concept? Sure.
It's a bit half-baked. But
unlike everything else on this show.
Oh, my God. I know. And it came from trying to address a pain point. I may have talked about little bits of this with you now, and I want to kind of bring this in front of a more public audience here and hear what their reactions to this are. One of the things I've noticed in 3D printing, whenever I've wanted to do projects, and sometimes it's a very simple thing. Sometimes it's things like I want to make something mechanical or make something, you know. There are not, if you're in the consumer space, there are not a lot of very basic things like nuts or bolts or screws and things like that. You can go to Thingiverse and maybe somebody's made a few of those things, but maybe they've never printed them. But you would think at this point we would have like a virtual hardware store, you know, that you could go and download, you know, a lot of things that are 3D printable, but that has not happened yet in the consumer space.
And specifically, I think the reason that it hasn't happened is, number one, it's very pedestrian. Number two, the logic is that, well, you know, whatever you make on a 3D printer won't be very stable. I wouldn't want to trust my, you know, children's stroller to rely on this nut or bolt or whatever. But you're not talking about that. You're talking about, like, sometimes you want these things just to be a 20-minute stand-in for
No, a lot of them are very stable. A lot of them are very – I think the reasons that you don't have them are, one is that all these repositories are crowdsourced.
Mm-hmm.
And you're relying on somebody to say, yeah, I will go through the effort to go produce this and then put this out there for everybody. And it's a lot like software in the early 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're designer generated. Most 3D repositories are – it's just crap to hold your other crap. It's this, hey, look at the skull mug I made, or look at this I made. You don't know how qualitative the stuff is, and some 3D repositories are like, oh yeah, everything's tested. Like, well, somebody in the crowd uploads it, but maybe they don't tell you that, oh yeah, you shouldn't use standard PLA plastic because that harbors bacteria, and if you make a cup from this, you're going to get sick, because maybe they didn't know. And it's a tragedy of the commons in many ways, in that you there's not a lot of incentivization there to put a lot of like a metric bolt, screws, things like this, angle brackets and all that. There's not an incentive to do that at this point. And my thought was to try to create a 3D repository that you could say, oh, I need a 3-inch screw with, you know, a 20-inch, you know, 20 thread per inch count, whatever metric, blah, 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 or imperial, you know, these things, and to have basically replicate a hardware store in a repository.
Yeah, no, I think certainly there's value to that. The question, of course, becomes how do you leverage motivation of you know the internet? I would say that some kind of Reddit-like karma kind of situation where people can upvote or downvote would be helpful. If
opposite way, I would go.
Oh, really?
I want to get away from the crowd. That totally want to get away from that, because I think the problem is that
how do you incentivize people to point out stuff like the harboring bacteria in PLA mugs or whatever?
You don't. You basically create a firm or a company or something where you then have your own engineers and people and technicians who test it and work on this stuff. Okay, that's what you do. Is that you basically say, instead of trying to create YouTube circa 2006, is you create Netflix. You create, you know, curated stuff that solves specific niches. Just say, okay, let's make bolts. Let's test them. Let's have our own people go test these things and make sure they work.
So
that would be.
So in that regard, so I guess the question becomes, why discuss this on the After Things podcast? In what way can those can our audience be involved?
I don't know.
Okay,
throwing this out there, Brian.
I thought you were setting it up to be workshopped or to come up with a crowdsourced kind of answer.
Well,
or something.
I'm saying that like I think the solution to the problem is that. How would you build a company or build something along those lines? Let's create 1,000 of the most common things that can be printed in a 1,000 items from a hardware store that can be reproduced. You know, How would you replicate those? You know, how would you do that? And then we're getting questions like Tensor guys asking questions like, how do you compete with mass produced stuff? Well, the answer is you don't. It depends. Is that you say if you can turn, there's a promise with a 3D printer. The promise when you buy this 3D printer is the idea that it becomes this, you know, it becomes this, you know, wonderful cornucopia machine that you can produce these things that you need. But the reality is you go look and you look at 3D repositories, you find things are untested, you find that they're crappy, you find that it's just tons of crap. It's man, you know, like you see these, like I see repositories, like, we got 30,000 items. Yeah, 20,000 of them are iPhone 4 holders.
Sure, sure.
You know? So, and the idea is like, how do you deliver on that promise? And I think step one on that promise is the idea of, I'm emotionally overcome here as I cough, is creating a repository of extremely practical stuff, like, you know, nuts and bolts and things like that, that you can use in certain criteria. There are many different kinds of filament now. In the last 5 years, we've gone from simple PLA things to nylon to actually there are now carbon materials that you can use, carbon fiber printers.
Okay, so can I make a couple suggestions? Because I think I see where you're headed now. If what you are offering is increased or superior models with more thought put into them that will be more practical and more usable. I like your parallel of a Netflix versus a YouTube. I think one of the things you need to do is similar to Netflix or maybe an Audible is you need to monetize in that people are spending money to get things, but I would figure out some scheme to have a monthly membership to a club, either an all-you-can-eat buffet a la Netflix or an Audible style. You get a number of credits and, you know, it's like, hey, man, you get 100 credits to spend and maybe a screw design is 2 credits and maybe, complicated valve is 5 credits or whatever.
I think that's on the nose exactly. And so this is – and I'm glad to hear you iterate that because this was my thinking is a – one level is I wanted to create a service that's useful for everybody and that could be free. And then I create a freemium level so anybody could have anybody could have access to these designs or models or things like that. Okay, anybody could have access to this. And Tensor guys, are you thinking of printing stuff yourself and shipping? No. The point is if you have a 3D printer, you use it to make it, you know. The idea is if you have a 3D printer and you want a 3/4-inch screw to fix some project or whatever, you have this file ready to go and print it. That's the whole idea is that it's a repository of a lot of things you'd get in a hardware store, but it turns your 3D printer into a hardware store. So on one level, you would have maybe like a free level, which would have like, you know, the 1,000 most common items in a hardware store. The next level up gets into a little more sophisticated stuff, things that are gadgets, things like that. Some of the stuff you've seen like I've made before, and that might be like the $4.99 a month level kind of thing, okay? You know, that might be like the level that pays for making these other things free. And so that one level, just to create something kind of like a thing to help humanity, is this idea of, hey, here's a thing that you can plug in your 3D printer in. You could even get into more complex stuff like an API where you could create a URL string that could describe the length and width of whatever of a screw or bolt you needed.
Sure.
And it could auto-generate that. But then to make it, you know, actually function as a, you know, as a service with updated stuff is, yeah, you need some sort of profit model.
So the profit model, try this on for size. Tell me, I know that when I first said it, because it wasn't what you were thinking of, I said crowdsource, but I wonder if there's a way to get what you want and still leverage the passionate nature of the internet. So what if, let's say, everyone can peruse anything for free, right? Everyone can participate in all the forums for free. For $4.99, you become a member. And once you're a member, you can, you know, spend credits to download the X, Y, and Z things. But what if there were credit bounties for things people wanted? For example, let's say at the freemium level, everybody can take a picture of a thing they need replicated. And then and let's say there's some kind of free voting, like, oh, that would be cool if that screw is available, or no, I don't think that's important, or whatever. But if you're a member, And let's say you're the person who designs that screw. It goes through the submission engine. It's vetted by whatever. And if it's found of a sufficient quality, you're awarded a 5-credit bounty. So now you're paying $5 a month just to be in the clubhouse. But now you're leveraging additional effort and building and you know, leveraging karma and reputation and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so the model I have is, instead of getting away from the credit model and all that, is,
sure,
is that you have one level. It's like pay one monthly fee, you get access to kind of everything. The other side of it, but would be a separate site even, is to put out bounties to say, we're looking for camera attachments for iPhones, we're looking for this, and just pay cash. Mm. Just pay cash as an incentive, you know, is get away, because you're the bounty and point system's only going to have a value to people if you're at a certain scale. But realistically, even Amazon's tried doing that kind of incentive level, and it doesn't work for doing certain kinds of things. You go to, there are sites where you have people who are like, say, hey, I will do 3D service for $10 an hour or whatever. But you say, hey, we're looking for, we want a new multi-tool that can be totally 3D printable. We'll pay $1,000 if you can, you know, sell us this design. Or we'll work out, you know, like Amazon has their KDP program, which basically is, if I put a book into the KDP program unlimited for, they say every month they have, like this month it's like $15 million, they could divide it up by the total number of page views. And so you can say, oh, this month we've got a $5 million bounty for whatever there. But the goal is, you want to make sure you have quality stuff in there. So in every one of these repositories, it's a bunch of crowdsourced crap to hold other crap, and it gets flooded with stuff. If you type in Bolt into one of these things, you get a bunch of things that aren't what you want. You can't find what you want. It's problematic. And you know, look, Bryce typed in Bolt, and the first thing on the upper right, we do have a Bolt, but it's just a sample thing. It's not like a specific whatever. It's the generic MakerBot, you know, this is what a Bolt would look like.
So I don't want to get into any kind of debate, but just to clarify, part of the reason that I'm attracted to doing credits instead of actual cash bounties is, if you're a talented modeler and you see the it's that economic view where once cash is brought into the equation, it becomes a transaction, and people start to evaluate, well, is an hour of my time really worth $35? Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I want to do it. But whereas credits, you know, it does, because I do feel like most of the people who are modeling and doing effort in the 3D space feel like they're part of a movement. And as long as it's not a crass cash transaction, I feel like you might be able to leverage more effort. But
my point is, that's the problem, is that I would rather, there's a lot of designers, not a lot of engineers. I would rather, how do I leverage people who are not participating?
Interesting.
Because the quality of stuff in the last 5 years hasn't gone up that much. And that's why let's create a Netflix model instead of a YouTube.
Got it. So you're saying all of a sudden, let's make auteurs out of these people. Let's make true artisans out of them, or demand
engineers.
Only those.
I mean, it's too much design, not enough engineering.
Yeah.
And I would say let's go to some kids, some guys in college and girls in college, and some people who work in engineering degrees and things like that, and say, hey, you know, we'll pay you $3,000 for a better vice if you can come up with this thing, or we'll create this profit sharing. Let's incentivize people who are not participating.
Open
software versus early 1980s, there was a lot of great free. It was a lot of tools for tools. Not in like the late 70s, early 80s, a lot of tools for tools, not a lot of this is how you get stuff done. And that's like, how do we move it into the next level?
Open Bayou has a really good point in the chat. He points out that Stack Overflow does a bounty system. I think Stack Overflow is, in a world where Stack Overflow has become the de facto grading tool for one's programming skills, and there are people who will not hire you unless you have a sufficient Stack Overflow reputation. I think doing a Stack Overflow of 3D engineering could be like, when what you're really doing is saying, hey, you're going to work really hard. You're going to design a lot of stuff. A lot of it's not going to get used. But at the end of the day, in 5 years, your skills are going to be very much in demand based on your demand, based on your reputation on this platform.
Yeah, there are a lot of directions to go into. And I think the problem is that for a lot of people, they get a 3D printer and they want to be able to make things, and they go online to repositories and they get GitHub when what they want is the App Store.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. Hey, man, we're creeping up on time. We're about to have to get ready for, I don't know if you heard, but we're up for a podcast award.
Yes.
They're going to have that.
I will do part two of this discussion next week. So.
Okay. Awesome. Dude, very, very good stuff. Do you have picks?
I do have a pick.
Yes.
Pick is the book Hackers by Stephen Levy.
Oh, I haven't read that one. Stephen Levy also did Inside the Googleplex, right?
Yeah, and Hackers is sort of the whole a story of a lot of the people that you never maybe heard of in the community of creating, you know, how do we get to where we are now with software? And it's fascinating too, because it's this, you look at from the early days of, you know, early days in the 1950s of, you know, where computation started to come faster and faster, people working with the old school, the TX0 computer, and like, you know, what was the first video game? And people say Space War, but arguably it was Mouse in a Maze, you know, which came before. And, you know, you get into the sort of this history of that, and it's, and it kind of is a weird touchback into that is, I was at the Magic Castle Friday night. I took Justin and his friends there, and there's a magician there by the name of Norman Galbraith, who has, you know, 80 years old, and which we know him from the Galbraith Method.
Yeah.
Principle. You know, he performed for us. Sweet, sweet old man. And I'm listening to this book, and they're talking about the guy named Donald Knuth, who put together a big book explaining different tech programming techniques. And this principle, which is a magic technique but also a sorting type thing, is in that book. You know, and it's sort of this weird thing. And to hear Marvin Minsky talked about, Marvin's a person that I knew. And just a fascinating sort of thing to think of how ancient it sounds, but how recent it is. You know, you talk about like the programming language of Lisp and how one of the creators of that is still with us.
Yeah.
Yet in some ways it feels like ancient history.
The Galbraith principle, tell me if I'm remembering this correctly. It's like if you have an entire deck of cards sorted red, black, red, black, red, black, you can shuffle that deck of cards. And no matter how you riffle shuffle it, if you pull off two cards off the top, they will always be one red and one black, although the order might swap. That's the Galbraith principle, right?
Something like that. Something like that.
Yeah, no, that's
magic methods.
It's a mathematical that's an interesting thing. Like what's the difference between a magic method and a mathematical axiom, or, you know, interesting. Okay. My pick is, Ego is the Enemy by Ryan Holiday. This was a very challenging book for me to read. I did not expect this. It is relentless in its, it challenged me very, very hard in that it made me question how much – first of all, it makes a very, very good case for why making egotistical decisions is not a good business.
Like choosing it 2 weeks in a row.
Yes. Well, I mean, now I've actually read it, though. That's the difference.
Okay.
one of the things is it explains why letting ego get in the way oftentimes results in extremely poor business decisions. The other thing is there's a lot of case studies of people who have let ego get in their way and other people who have overcome ego. You know, one of the, of course, most prominent stories is Steve Jobs very much left Apple, over ego. It was a clash of egos between the two of them, and he left to start his own thing. And his return, in many ways, was him conquering ego. You know, from being the guy who would park in handicapped parking places because he could, to becoming the guy who, you know, with a heart of in spirit of trying to save fledgling Apple, came back and knocked it out of the park. You know, there's also a lot of quotes from Greek philosophers and Roman philosophers, and, you know, you're hearing from Plutarch and Stoicism and so on. But the entire time I found myself really comparing various decisions I made with business, like asking, like, was that truly because this mattered, or was this because I had built up a picture of who I am and I needed to match that picture for fear of – you know, not looking consistent or any other stupid irrelevant thing. And my favorite part out of the whole thing was in the audiobook, there's a 1 hour interview between him and Tim Ferriss at the end, where something you don't get a lot of in the book is him talking about his personal experiences. And instead, for some reason, hearing him say many of the same things in the books framed as actual events that he went through with his work, both working at and consulting for the board at American Apparel or whatever, and the difficulties and the panic attacks he had, and the lack of proper prioritization. It was really, really challenging, really, really good, and I think ultimately something I needed to hear, as difficult as it was, and I highly, highly recommend it.
That's good. We get the version of events often after it happens, and we always get the version of events after it happens, how we recall them and how we got there. And we want to tell the story where everything sort of makes sense. And we want to be the personal journey, you know, to be the one where we've completed the journey.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Is that, I guess that, you know, if I'm going to sit down and tell you the story of how I got to here, I'm going to assume that here is really the place that I need to end up being and not the fact that I'm really far away from where.
Well, and one of my favorite parts of the book was when he talks about, and again, the case studies are extraordinary. He talks about military commanders that you've never heard of, but that were unarguably some of the most important people in all of shaping history. And I forget the name of the was it Marshall? I think it was Marshall who refused to sit down, or he sat down for commissioned paintings of him, but then the moment it was over, he got up and the painter said to General Marshall, "Well, don't you want to see the painting?" And he goes, "Nope," and then off he went. And it's like, you know, it talks about the benefits of why you should aspire to be that kind of person, because it's somebody who focuses on what truly is important and enjoys the benefits of doing the thing that is what really matters, not from the trappings or what other people the things, because ultimately none of that matters. Anyway, I liked it a lot.
Yeah, that sounds great. I one of my heroes is George Washington, and who was a guy that said, "Hey, I don't really want a monument, you know, like I think this thing we built here is really awesome and I'm happy being associated with that." And we're like, "Okay, no monument, but we're gonna give him a giant phallic symbol."
Yes, yes, exactly. one other point that's in the book that I thought was really poignant was he talks about people who are consumed with slights from years and years and years ago. And in fact, there's a fantastic story about how William Randolph Hearst heard about Citizen Kane and heard that it's kind of maybe about him. And of course, you know, Charles Foster Kane was an amalgam of a bunch of different people. William Randolph Hearst lost
mostly his, Hearst.
Well, okay, that's fine. But he lost his crap. He said nobody will ever mention an RKO Pictures anything on any Hearst publication ever. And kept to it. And you know, just this insane stuff. And it leads to this one moment that apparently really happened, where Orson Welles was in an elevator with Charles Foster Kane, or I'm sorry, with William Randolph Hearst, and as they're going up, you know, he was like, "Oh yeah, hey, you want to come see the movie? The premiere's on so and so." William Randolph Hearst is like, "No, I'll never see your movie." And then Orson Welles goes, "Huh, Charles Foster Kane would have," and then left the elevator. It's so many great moments, because Orson Welles was somebody who truly kept his eye on what was really important and didn't get lost in the other stuff, whereas William Randolph Hearst, you know, did get lost in all that stuff. Anyway, lots of great stories.
Yeah. Brian?
You?
Bryce, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.